Lecture 16. From Sparta to Persia.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I want to divide this lecture into two. In the first part, I want to conclude our discussion of Sparta with some observations on Spartan society that show its weaknesses. And then in the second part, I want to take us into the era of the Persian Wars, which, to me, end the archaic period. So let's begin with Sparta. As we've seen over the last few lectures, the Spartans grew up in a military society in which fighting for the state and dying for the state were placed first. Family life and participation in political activities were placed second. Serving the state honourably and giving your life in proper fashion to it were everything. All of these things, especially the importance the Spartans placed, or rather didn't place, on politics and the family, were abhorrent to other Greeks. In Athens, for example, Solon had passed a law that any citizen, male citizen that is, who did not take part in political life was to be punished. And Aristotle would later coin the phrase, man is a political animal. So it's hardly a surprise that the Spartans were admired and disliked by other Greeks at the same time. If the Spartans had maintained a lifestyle that cut them off from the rest of the Greeks, like living in a commune or something, then they may well have led a model existence compared to life in other polis. But they didn't. They didn't live in a commune. And as we talked about in the last lecture, the Peloponnesian League and the reputation of the Spartan army drew the Spartans into affairs well beyond the Peloponnese. For example, in 546, Croesus of Lydia went to war against the Persian king. The details of this don't concern us here, but the bottom line is that Croesus needed allies. This was an audacious move on his part, and so he turned to Sparta for support. His move shows that the reputation of Sparta's army had travelled far and wide, across the Aegean to Asia Minor, in fact. The Spartans didn't help Croesus, and we'll talk about why in a moment. This was a Croesus, by the way, who consulted the oracle to find out whether he should rebel, whether he should wage war on the king. And he received the usual cryptic answer along the lines of, if you do, a great empire will fall. Well, one did. It was his own. Sparta's reputation on the mainland was also paramount. As we know, in 510, the Alcmaeonidae of Athens had successfully pressured the priestess of Apollo at Delphi to urge the Spartans to liberate Athens from the tyranny. That family didn't get the Pythia to put pressure on Thebes or Corinth or anywhere else, but on Sparta. Sparta's social and military developments might sound great, and they contributed to the Spartan mirage, as we talked about in our first lecture on Sparta. But the social and military developments would affect the city detrimentally, because they involved Sparta in central Greek affairs. It was something the Spartans never wanted to and never expected to happen, I think. Was this naive on their part? We just don't know. Another thing that affected the Spartans detrimentally was their reliance on a captive people, the Helots, that far outnumbered them to provide the people with sustenance. As I said before, the Helots were the economic backbone of Sparta. So with these sorts of qualifications, shall we say, the Spartans were anything but poised to take on a role in wider Greek affairs. The refusal to help Croesus in Asia Minor is an example of this. The principal reason they gave to Croesus was because of the distance involved. And at first sight, this makes sense. It's a long way to Asia Minor. However, when the Spartans had enslaved the Messenians in that first Messenian war, and they turned them into Helots, the Spartans had created an Achilles heel for themselves in their domestic security and in their foreign affairs. The Helots outnumbered them, And so the Spartans were forced to be careful not to commit large forces elsewhere in Greece or especially overseas. If they did that, then that would diminish manpower reserves at home should the Helots choose to revolt. So we see another reason for their refusal to help Croesus. It's not going to get any better. Marching to Athens, on the other hand, in 510, and even that second time in 508 to support Isagoras, that was entirely different. Athens was not as far away as Lydia. If there was a Helot revolt, then any Spartan force could return home fairly quickly. They'd be home in a matter of days. And in any case, the government back home, that's back home in Sparta, could call on the members of the Peloponnesian League for assistance. Remember I said that by the time that the Spartans expelled Hippias from Athens in 510, that Peloponnesian League was well up and running. Besides, there was already enmity between Athens and Sparta. That was another reason for the Spartans marching on Athens. But who was this Croesus anyway? And even if they helped him, what might they get out of it? Suddenly finding yourself in a situation you have no experience of is not necessarily the end of the world. Look at me in a studio. You can adapt. You can learn. But the Spartans never really did this. To make matters worse, Sparta suffered a declining population that impacted on its fighting strength. This was what its society was all about in the first place, wasn't it? Its fighting strength. In 479, at the Battle of Plataea, that's the last battle on the mainland of the Persian Wars, there were about 8,000 men in the Spartan army. 5,000 of these served at that battle in the same year. But a century later, in 371, only 700 Spartans fought against Thebes at the Battle of Leuctra in Boeotia. And in 330 BC, Aristotle tells us that there were only 1,000 Spartans left, presumably Spartiates. Now, Leuctra, the Battle of Leuctra in 371, was a crucially important battle because it falls in the period known as the Spartan hegemony. This lasted from 404, when the Spartans defeated the Athenians in the Peloponnesian War, to 371. As this period of the Spartan hegemony wore on, Sparta's leadership proved unpopular, and the Thebans decided to take them on in battle in 371, hence Leuctra. Now they won, and as a result, Sparta's ascendancy over Greece came to an end. So the Spartans knew that Leuctra was a make-or-break battle. They had to win it to continue their hegemony. If they lost it, they would lose everything. Plataea in 479 was also a make-or-break battle. A win there for the Greeks would end the Persian presence in Greece. Yet in 371, Sparta could only send 700 hoplites to fight at Leuctra compared to the 5,000 in 479. In 100 years, look at the difference. When other polis were experiencing population increases, the Spartan population decline is startling. Why? Why does it happen? Well, one explanation is the number of Spartans who died in battle. Remember the Spartan ethos, which was to stand firm and die rather than live to fight another day. The exposure of male babies who were deemed unfit wouldn't have helped with population numbers either. And then we can build in natural deaths and natural disasters. For example, in 464, there was a massive earthquake in the Peloponnese. I mean, this was huge. It killed a great many Spartans. Oh, triple figures, probably quadruple figures even. Because we know that the entire core of Ephebs, that's the boys in the Agoge between the ages of 14 to 20, those who had begun to take part in military campaigns, that entire core of Ephebs was killed in the earthquake. It was gone. So that means that an entire rank, if you like, that was next in line to serve full-time in the army was no more. There's also a theory that because the men were so often away on campaign or dying, And even when they were home, they spent so much time in the Syssition that they weren't having sex with their wives all that often, not as often as they should have been doing. That means that the women were not becoming pregnant as often as they could, and so the women were having fewer babies. Whatever the reasons, and everything that we've been talking about so far is probably true, there's no question that Sparta was facing problems as no other polis was. And there's no question that these problems detrimentally affected Sparta as time continued. The toughest and best trained army in Greece, sure, but at what cost? Here we finish our analysis of Sparta, at least the growth of Sparta as a polis, the growth of Sparta as head of the Peloponnesian League. We are, of course, going to be coming back to Sparta a lot in this course, but we've needed to talk about Sparta as we've been doing to set the scene. I hope you've formed your own views about the Spartans and their society, but I do hope you don't follow this Spartan mirage line. The Spartans did not have this ordered society at all. I think that really is a mirage. If the deteriorating relations between Athens and Sparta weren't bad enough and, you know, forecast doom and gloom down the track, then by the start of the 5th century, Greece was feeling the presence of another power that would cause it much grief. And that power was Persia. And so we move to the second part of our lecture now, the prelude to the Persian Wars. And as I've said before, these wars are the backdrop to the growth in Athenian imperialism in the 5th century. And they also bring, for me, the archaic period to an end and usher in the classical. I've said to you a couple of times now about the Persian Wars bringing the archaic period to an end. I should perhaps point out here that there is a line of thought that would actually have the archaic period ending where we are now, and the Persian Wars actually starting the classical period. Well, I actually don't accept that. I don't buy that line. So for me, I sleep happy at night thinking that the Persian Wars bring the archaic period to an end because there's such a change in Greek history. The changes that happened to Greece after the Persian Wars are as radical as after the 8th century Renaissance. Now, the Persian Empire was enormous. It stretched from Thrace, modern Bulgaria, across the Hellespont, the Dardanelles, to Asia Minor, the modern Turkey. It ran through Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, to Pakistan. And it had Egypt and the Levantine coast included in it for good measure. It was enormous. It was also too vast for one person to control it effectively. That was why a king called Darius, who was king from 522 to 486, divided the empire into 20 administrative regions called satrapies. And each satrapy was headed by a satrap who was appointed by the great king. The great king, by the way, that's the official title of the Persian king. Now, Darius is the king that we're going to be dealing with in this lecture and in the next one. The satrap had to pay an annual tax to the great king, as well as levy troops as and when needed. But apart from that, the satrap was pretty much left to his own devices in his satrapy. Ultimately, though, real power lay in the hands of the great king. The great king ruled absolutely. The Greeks of the mainland didn't know a great deal about the Persians. They were swayed by stories of how rich the great king was and how big and invincible the Persian army was. Now, this last point is important for us. How big and how invincible was the Persian army? The Greeks called the Persians barbarians. Now, this word doesn't mean uncivilized in the sense that we use it. It means that the Persians didn't speak Greek. To the Greeks, anyone who didn't speak Greek sounded like he or she was saying bar-bar, bar-bar. a bit like the baaing of sheep. Out of this bar, 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 came the Greeks coining the word barbaroi, barbarians. The Persian artifacts that we see in museums or on sites today are testimony to the high degree of Persian craftsmanship. And the Greeks would have been aware of this as well. The Greeks knew about the Persians' artistic talents. So it's important to understand that when Greeks call other peoples, not just the Persians, but when Greeks call other peoples barbarians, they simply mean that they don't speak Greek. And that's a big distinction for the Greeks, because anybody who speaks Greek is cool, is better than those who don't speak Greek. The Persian Wars have their origins in what's called the Ionian Revolt, and this broke out in 499 BC. We go to the coast of Asia Minor for this. And on that coast, there were a number of Ionian cities that had been part of the Persian Empire since Cyrus, the Persian king Cyrus, conquered Croesus of Lydia in about 546. When Cyrus conquered Croesus, he took over Lydia, and that included the coastline of Asia Minor. Now, these Ionian cities, these Greek settlements on the coastline of Asia Minor, paid a tribute to the great king, and they were forced to live under the rule of Persian-backed tyrants. So they weren't autonomous or anything like that. The Persian king imposed tyrants in each of these cities to keep them in check. Well, by 499 BC, so we've just moved now into the 5th century, the Ionian cities had had enough of this situation. It seems that Darius was increasing their tribute, and he may even have been imposing trade restrictions on them. So enough became enough. In that same year, in 499, the tyrant of Miletus, a chap called Aristagoras, stepped down from power, gave up his tyranny, and he called on the Ionian cities to revolt from their tyrants and to defy the great king. Now, this was a bold move on his part, and Aristagoras of Miletus knew that the Ionians themselves couldn't resist Darius. Darius was too powerful, could levy these huge armies if he needed to. So Aristagoras needed help, needed support. He went to the mainland of Greece to solicit help, and there are no prizes for guessing the first place he went to, Sparta. I said there were no prizes. But Herodotus, and we'll talk more about Herodotus in the next lecture, Herodotus, the father of history. Herodotus tells the story that when Aristagoras went to Sparta and told the king Cleomenes that Darius lived 3 months' march from the sea, Cleomenes sent him packing. Once again, the distance factor, you see. Distance and helots combine for the Spartans. In the end, only Athens and the city of Eretria on the island of Euboea, which is to the east of central Greece, only Athens and Eretria sent help. 20 ships from the Athenians, 5 ships from the Eretrians. Now, the high point in the Ionian Revolt came in 498, a year after it started, with the burning of Darius's most westerly palace at Sardis. The great king had a number of palaces throughout the Persian Empire. He and his court toured around, went from one to the other, often depending on the season, summer, winter, etc. And Sardis was the most westerly one. And the Greeks captured it, and they looted it, and they burned it. Now, the following year, in 497, the Athenians and the Eretrians returned home. Now, over the next few years, the Ionian cities enjoyed some successes against the Persian king. But in 494, their fleet was decisively defeated at the Battle of Lade, which was near Miletus, just off the coast from Miletus. The Ionian Revolt was therefore over. Darius now re-established control of the entire coastline of Asia Minor, and he decided he was going to punish Miletus hard because Miletus had spearheaded the revolt. So he gave orders that all the men in Miletus were to be seized, and they were sent to live at the mouth of the Tigris River. As for the women and children, he gave orders that they be seized and sold as slaves. So in effect, Miletus was depopulated. Now, this punishment sent shockwaves throughout the Greek world. And there's a story that when a playwright in Athens called Phrynichus wrote a tragedy entitled The Capture of Miletus, this brought back so many memories for the Athenians that they fined him 1,000 drachmas. As for Darius, once he finished depopulating Miletus, he started to get mad. He got really enraged at the burning of the Sardis Palace, and he blamed Athens and Eretria for this. So he decided on a punitive mission to Greece. And in 492, that's just 2 years after the end of the Ionian Revolt, he sent a fleet against the Greeks under his son-in-law Mardonius. Well, this fleet hugged the coast of the North Aegean rather than sail directly across the Aegean to Euboea and then Attica. And we know it hugged the coastline of the North Aegean because bad weather around the Chalcidice wreaked havoc with it, and it was forced to go back to Persia. So the 492 attempt was abortive. Darius tried again in 490. This time he sent a fleet commanded by his nephew Artaphernes and a Persian named Datis. And this time the fleet sailed across the Aegean to Euboea. So in 490 we have a more serious invasion threat, a Persian fleet sailing directly across the Aegean. It was going to attack Euboea and burn Eretria, then it was going to attack the Athenians. This is the 490 invasion that will lead to the Battle of Marathon. Now we get to a big question. Did Darius intend this 490 mission, this mission to punish Eretria and Athens for supporting the Ionian Revolt, or did he have something else in mind? This is important. As we'll see in the next lecture, this 490 mission ended in Persian defeat at Marathon. The Athenians defeated the Persians at Marathon. In 481, a decade later, Darius's son Xerxes, the more famous Persian king, Xerxes invaded Greece. He was intent on conquering it out of revenge for the Persian defeat at Marathon. Now, often when we talk about the Persian Wars, we mean Xerxes' invasion. We talk about the Persian Wars as the period sort of 480 to 479. So does that mean that the 490 campaign, the one that Darius sent, is a prelude to Xerxes' invasion? Or should it be considered part of the Persian Wars as a whole? Should we therefore talk about the Persian Wars period as 490 to 479? Well, a lot depends on Darius's aims. According to Herodotus, Darius's mission was not just to punish Athens and Eretria and leave it at that. He was using the burning of Sardis as a pretext to extend Persian influence over the whole of Greece. In other words, Darius intended to conquer Greece and absorb it into his empire. Now, this is possible. Persia for some time now had been getting involved in northern Greece. The Persian force in 492 under Mardonius, you know, the one that was wrecked and had to return to Persia. Before that had happened to it, it had conquered the northern Aegean island of Thasos and it had made some advances into Macedonia. It was logical that as Darius expanded his empire westwards, he would set his sights on the Greek mainland. It was Darius, for example, who had taken over the area of Thrace, conquered the Thracians and made Thrace a satrapy. Moreover, Darius sent messengers to all of the Greek states demanding earth and water. Now, earth and water were tokens of submission, and apparently a number of states complied, including Argos and Thebes. These messengers, by the way, were put to death in Athens and Sparta, so it's pretty clear what those two states thought of Darius's demands. The 490 mission seems set on conquering Greece then. So we could well say that had Athens and Eretria not supported the Ionian Greeks, Darius would still have invaded Greece, intent on reducing it to submission. You can see why the issue is important. Who's to blame for the Persian Wars? That is to say, if Darius had already intended to subjugate Greece as part of some Western imperialistic policy, then ultimately it wouldn't have mattered whether any mainland state or no mainland state had supported the Ionian Revolt. We can't blame anyone then. But let's step back a moment and rethink whether the 490 campaign should be seen as part of the Persian Wars. You're probably thinking now, uh-oh, there's another heresy coming up. Yes, there is. I think there are grounds to argue that Darius did not intend to conquer all of Greece. For one thing, he didn't himself lead the Persians against the Greeks. He stayed in Persia. The forces he sent, both in 492 and 490, were not substantial ones. They were enough to attack two cities like Eretria and Athens, but not to take on all the Greeks. And he would have heard, of course, of the fighting capability of the Spartan army. Everyone had. So if he wanted to take over all of Greece, he must have known that at some stage he was going to have to fight the Spartans. And for that, he would have needed more troops. Also, accompanying the Persian attack force in 490 was the former tyrant of Athens, Hippias. Now, this was the one who'd been expelled by a Spartan force in 510. This is Hippias, son of Pisistratus. Well, Hippias had ended up in Sygeum on the Troad, and eventually he'd ended up in one of the courts of the Persian satraps. He was now elderly, probably, 70s, maybe even 80s. So his return to Greece is very interesting, I think. Darius must have wanted to install him as ruler of Athens. That's the only reason to bring him back. But if Darius wanted to conquer all of Greece, why would he bring Hippias back and then to rule only one place? It makes more sense for the 490 invasion to be a punitive one against Eretria, which, no disrespect intended to the Eretrians, was a piddly little place after all, and a punitive one against Athens as well. And given Athens' economic and cultural reputation by now, how sweet it would be for Darius to control it via a puppet ruler, i.e. Hippias. You're probably now thinking of the flaw to my argument. What about Darius's messengers to the Greeks demanding earth and water? If he was only moving against Eretria and Athens, why send messengers to every Greek state? Well, it's a good argument that you throw against me. But I suspect that Darius was simply testing the waters to see how the Greeks might react. His main aim was likely to be the punishment of Athens and Eretria. These are the two that had together had helped to burn the palace at Sardis, and that's what enraged him the most. But if any other state happened to submit to him, given the stories of, here we go again, the invincibility of the Persian army, you see, I said that was important for us, the invincibility of the Persian army might well cause other states who didn't know any better to submit automatically to Persia. That, together with news of the fate of Miletus, you know, oh, if we resist Darius, the same thing could happen to us, that then might cause states to submit to him, and that would be icing on the cake. But even thicker icing would be the surrender to him of the Spartans. Now, given the Spartans' reluctance to commit forces elsewhere. I mean, the story of why Cleomenes rejected Aristagoras would be well known. I mean, this would have circulated widely by now. Given the Spartans' enmity with the Athenians, also well known, Darius wouldn't have expected them to support the Athenians when he marched on Athens. Events proved him right, as we'll see next time. But deep down, Darius probably knew that the Spartans would never submit to him. But what harm was there in trying? After all, as the modern expression goes, you have to be in it to win it. And so in 490, Darius launches this fleet against the Greeks. However, the Persians were in for a shock when they landed on mainland Greek soil at Marathon. The stories of the might and invincibility of the Persian army would prove to be just that, stories. Those stories would end abruptly on the battlefield of Marathon, thanks to the genius of the Athenian strategos Miltiades. And we will deal with this in our next lecture. Thank you very much.